Well, good afternoon. As any event organiser knows, the most important thing by far is how's the food? And I thought it was excellent, so I hope you enjoyed lunch too. And thanks for those that provided it. Now, in this afternoon's session, with an eye to the schedule, John Trowbridge is going to speak for a little more than the allocated time. So we're allowing 10 minutes extra for that time. And John will take your questions by SMS in the way that we've been doing it. Then Alex Sanchez, Carl Jones and Stephen Jeffrey will talk about flood insurance, flood mapping and flood pricing. So overall, this session goes a little bit longer, taking afternoon tea at about 5 to 3, though we're tightening up later in the day, so we'll still finish at 5 o'clock. Let me get to John. Of course, he was appointed chairman of the government's Natural Disaster Insurance Review Panel in March 2011, so he's got an interesting job on his hands, and it's at the centre of what we're talking about today. The panel was appointed by the Assistant Treasurer with a brief to review the availability and affordability of insurance for floods and other natural disasters. In 2010, John completed a four-year term as one of three government-appointed executive members of APRA. He had carriage at APRA of life and general insurance and also executive remuneration, so he likes to take on the tough jobs. As people know, before joining APRA, John had spent the larger part of his career as a consultant, having founded Trowbridge Consulting in 1981, a firm which was known as an insurance specialist and became a leading actuarial and management consulting firm in Australia and Asia during the 80s and 90s. So please welcome John Trowbridge.
Thanks very much, Peter, for that introduction. And may I thank the Institute also for putting on this seminar today and giving me the opportunity to introduce some ideas for you, which I'm going to do, as to where our panel is going. Let me just make a couple of introductory remarks first, though. I'm one of three members of the review panel. The other two are John Beryl, who's a solicitor in Melbourne with Maurice Blackburn, and he's got a lot of experience in dealing with insurance claims. Also Jim Minto, who's somewhere in the audience here. Jim Minto, head of Tower Life, is also on the panel, so we've got three of us as the panel, but we've also got a secretariat of numerous people led by Christine Barron, who's also in the audience from Treasury in Canberra. The Australian Government Actuary, Peter Martin, is here. He's working with us. And Graham Adams, who had a long career with IAG, is also helping us out. So we've been putting a lot of effort in over the last 2 months or so. We've been going through an investigation phase because we decided at the outset that our review should be we should do investigation first before we should start looking at solutions. Then we'll try and assess the information we've got, and then we'll come up with some design proposals and complete our report. We're well advanced now with the investigation phase, but we are concentrating on completing an issues paper, which we've scheduled to be released at the end of this month. So that's only a couple of weeks away now. And the terms of reference, for those of you who haven't seen them, they cover all aspects of all natural disasters, flood, earthquake, cyclone, bushfire, and also all aspects of personal lines insurance and, well, not all personal lines, but householders insurance, contents, and small business. I'm going to talk to you today about a restricted part of that, which is flood insurance for home buildings or residential buildings. And you know why that is, because the big issue for everybody, certainly for the insurance industry, and Rob Whelan, we don't have to tell you the big issue here. The big issue, of course, is not about Cyclone Yasi. It's not about the flash floods or the storms in Toowoomba and the Lockyer Valley. It is about the fact that there were riverine floods in Ipswich and Brisbane areas, and many of the people who had insurance cover did not have cover for floods. Many of them didn't have any cover, and a number of them had only partial cover. And that's what's given rise to the huge controversy about these floods from an, of these disasters from an insurance point of view, and it's clearly troubled the insurance industry a lot because they've done, on the whole, they've done a terrific job handling. You think of the disasters we've had in Australia the last few years: 2007 Hunter Valley storms and flooding, the bushfires in Victoria, the big storms last year, in hailstorms in Melbourne and Perth, and now all this, all these disasters up in Queensland, plus flooding in Victoria. And all of that has passed with, I think, a pretty good record for the insurance industry, but the flood issue is clearly the one that's hurting them publicly, and which is and the reason is because the public and many members of house owners and have been really severely caught out by this. Well, what I'm going to talk about is some options, if you like, that we, the panel, have come to. But let me just begin in terms of the subject matter by talking briefly about the terms of reference. The terms of reference include some government objectives, one of which is that the government, this is the federal government, of course, seeks to ensure that, and I'm quoting, individuals and communities at risk of future flooding or other extreme weather events are aware of the risks but are able to obtain suitable protection against those risks, both in terms of having access to insurance and benefiting from appropriate mitigation strategies. And that's in really direct response to the things I was just referring to. Then there are three guiding principles referred to in the terms of reference. The first one is that government intervention in private insurance markets is justifiable only where, and to the extent that there is clear failure by those private markets to offer appropriate cover at affordable premiums. And I think it's pretty clear that that condition has not been met by current market situations. That is to say, their private markets are very thin or non-existent for some people, and also for some people or some property owners where cover is available, it can be at a very high price and people just don't buy it. But it's equally clear, and you've heard a lot about it this morning, that mitigation is relevant. To quote, the appropriate mitigation of risk by individuals and governments at all levels is a key objective. And finally, which is in line with what Mike Rothery was talking about, individuals and businesses should be encouraged to insure themselves where practicable. In other words, there's people are meant to take responsibility themselves where that's reasonable. So that's a bit of that's really the background. Let me now talk about the three main flood cover options which are available. The status quo is that essentially we've got a free market in Australia in most classes of insurance. So insurers are free to offer flood cover and they're free not to offer flood cover. And people who own properties are free to insure their properties with flood cover or without flood cover. So by the time you get through those two things and you look at the history in Australia, the fact is that many people don't have flood cover. The insurers don't have to offer it, and many don't, and although some do, and even if they do offer it, you don't have to buy it. That's one model. And that's where we are today. The next one, the middle one on this slide, I've called opt-out. This is an alternative where it could be put that all insurers have to offer full flood cover, but you still give owners the opportunity, if they wish, or the option, if they wish, to buy insurance with flood cover or without flood cover. And the third option, which I would call full flood cover, is that same in terms of insurers for the first as the opt-out model, all insurers are obliged to offer full flood cover, but also all property owners who buy insurance buy it with flood cover. So either you buy cover with flood insurance or you have no insurance at all against fire or anything else. So they're the three main options that that we've been considering. And it's pretty clear, I don't think I have to elaborate to this audience very much on why the full flood cover would be the desirable option if it could be made to work. Because if there's full flood cover, then you don't need hydrologists, you don't need a distinction between between storm and flood. Everybody who's got water damage, I'll leave aside actions of the sea, that's a separate topic, but basically most water damage, nearly all water damage, is from storm, rain, flood of some kind. And if all insurers offered full flood cover, then there would never need to be the distinction. You either have insurance or you don't have insurance. Now, that would be a much simpler option. That would have... and essentially, that is what happened Lockyer Valley and Toowoomba, as I was saying before, because there were not riverine floods there. Almost everybody who had an insurance policy was covered, and there were no arguments. Well, there were some arguments about individual claims, but there was no debate about whether you had what the cause of the water damage was. Now, that raises some pretty interesting questions, doesn't it? Because you end up with something a little bit like what this chart tries to suggest, and I'm not going to explain in any depth around affordability. That itself is a topic that needs to be looked at quite carefully, because affordability on the one hand is all about whether you have the willingness and the ability to pay, and that can vary enormously for individuals irrespective of the risk. But just taking the general idea that at the moment, affordability is about the reasonableness of premiums. If you take as a reference point existing non-flood premiums, there's no debate in Australia, as far as I'm aware, that would suggest that people can't afford to buy home insurance for their properties. And most people do, as a matter of fact. Information we've got suggests that more than 95% of homeowners do insure their properties. And we'll explain in the issues paper where that information comes from. In fact, in the Canberra bushfires, as an example, we've learned that only 6 properties out of nearly 600 that were burned down were uninsured. So the level of non-insurance is not very high, and that also suggests that people who want to own a property can afford to buy the insurance. So if you take that as a reference point, then we do have a situation where for most people flood insurance is affordable, but for some people it is not. So you can see how this chart works. Availability is really about the insurers making the insurance available, offering the cover. And under the status quo, for most people, it is available now, but not for everybody. The companies that do offer it at such a high price, or they either underwrite or price themselves out in the higher flood risk area. So it's kind of a bit debatable whether it really is, how widely available it is today, but it is fairly widely available. It's clearly unaffordable for many people in the sense that they've chosen not to buy it where they had the option. And that means that access to flood insurance is not at the level that it would need to be to resolve the problems that have led to the existence of our review. On the opt-out model and on the full flood model, affordability, if you just run down the path of individual insurers pricing the risk the way they would think it should be priced and offering it, well, it clearly wouldn't be affordable then either. The question really is, and the question that the review panel is considering, is whether there could be some kind of mechanism put in place to make such insurance affordable. And if you can, then in the case of the opt-out model, you still wouldn't guarantee access to everybody, because people would still have the opportunity to, after receiving their quote for insurance, including flood, could say, good, thanks, but no thanks, I don't want to buy it. So the opt-out model doesn't look like it would really solve the problem that we're facing. On the other hand, the full flood model, if you can solve the affordability problem, you may be able to solve the access problem as well. Well, let me just now, I want to come to one topic, which is the critical piece for this afternoon's discussion from the point of view of the panel, but I want to just explain a little more about the implications of having full flood cover. The primary benefit, as it doesn't take a lot to realise this, the primary benefit is it would, as I've already said, it would eliminate non-insurance for flood, and therefore it would eliminate disputes over the cause of water damage. But it may also generate, more confidence in the insurance system, and that's important not just to the insurance industry itself, but you know, many of you will have heard the anecdotal criticisms of the industry and the fact that people, a lot of people, just don't trust the industry. So if you could have full flood cover for everybody, I think that would be a very positive thing for both the community and for the insurance industry and for governments as well. And, of course, it would give some brand protection for insurers. But there are three things you would have to solve, three problems you would have to solve to be able to go down this route. The first one is to be able to give discounts on higher risk properties. Second one is you have, in other words, there's a pricing job to be done, a pricing task. How do you price the insurance for those higher risk properties, given that we're going to have to find some way of discounting their premiums so that they're affordable? Secondly, if you do offer discounts to those people, you've got to find a way of funding those discounts somewhere, because the whole premium pool is short, isn't it, if you offer discounts to anybody at all. And before you can do either of those things, you have to be able to identify which properties are the higher risk ones and which are not. And that's the topic that I think is the most interesting one in terms of today's seminar, because today's seminar is not exclusively about insurance. It is about the whole gamut of flood issues. And what it needs, if you're going to do anything of the kind I'm talking about, you need to be able to establish some kind of a threshold above which or beyond which properties are treated as high risk and below which they are treated as low risk. Now, if you assume that the threshold is set properly, then all the risks that are below the threshold, we would expect that the private market could continue to offer insurance for as it does today. We have a competitive market, actually, already today for flood insurance, where the flood insurance risk is either nil, which is true for more than 90% of the houses in Australia, but it also still works for quite a few properties that have some flood risk. But once the flood risk reaches, I don't know what the price threshold is, but once the price gets, let's say, 20, 30, 40, 50% more than the price without flood insurance, then you run into affordability and access problems for people. So somewhere in that area probably is a reasonable maximum price that you could ask people to pay. And if you can find such a threshold, then why wouldn't you just let the insurance market continue to operate in the way it does today? But how do you reach this threshold? As you can see from the slide here, there are two distinctly different kinds of techniques that we think might be able to be employed. And I say might quite deliberately, because there's a lot of thinking, a lot of work to be done, and indeed a lot of input that we want from after our issues paper is released from all the people who've got an interest in this. But you could use what I've called here engineering techniques, where the general idea would be that using flood mapping techniques, you identify geographical boundaries which which define high-risk properties versus low-risk properties. And anybody, any property inside the high-risk boundary would be we would assume then under this concept, would not be getting its insurance in the normal way, would not be relying on the free market insurance offerings. Now, there are a lot of reasons why this might be a good idea. There are reasons why it mightn't be a good idea. For example, as I understand it, and I'm no expert on flood mapping, but assessing flood risk on a geographical basis, of itself, it doesn't take account of the particular features of an individual building. And, of course, you can have, in a flood-prone area, depending on the type of the building construction, you can have one property that's flooded and damaged and nearly destroyed, and next door you can have one that's barely damaged just because the second one's on some kind of stilts or stumps and has got a different layout of the design of the building. So anyway, the question here is it possible to design some kind of high-risk boundary where all the houses outside that boundary are just subject to the normal open market, and where properties inside are seen to be high risk, and I leave open the question of whether, once you've identified the high risk properties, whether all of them should get some kind of discount. Because as we've heard in some of the discussions this morning, there may be a case for giving no discounts to any new properties that are built there, but giving some kind of discounts to existing properties. So there's a range of ways of dealing with that kind of issue. So I'm really trying to draw a distinction. Firstly, there's a high-risk threshold where you've got some kind of system or scheme in operation for the high-risk properties and those who are not. But within that, there are a whole range of possible ways in which you might carry out the insurance, because I make no statement about how you would set the discounts and how you would fund the discounts. So our issues paper will cover those questions, but I'm not going to go there today. I'm simply talking here about the threshold. So if those of you who are interested in flood mapping and know about it can turn your minds to how this sort of thing might work. And I know there are some people advocating this out there, there are a number of things to think about. If you rely on flood maps, you've got all the uncertainties that Mark talked about this morning. You've got what somebody thinks is a 1 in 100 year flood level might turn out to be a 1 in 10 year flood level, depending on what's happened and on how good the mapping is and what the local characteristics are, etc. And there's the building and land features to go with that. The other idea is to use what I've called here an insurance market mechanism. The concept here is that basically you would have some kind of a price threshold. I mentioned before that you might be able to assume that the private market could operate up to 120, 140, 150%, say, of a non-flood premium, and everybody's expected to buy cover that way. And then above that price threshold, then you have some different mechanism for pricing and then funding the insurance. Now, the biggest possible problem with a system like that is that if the insurer sees that if you had a threshold of, say, 140%, and the insurer thought, well, this is only 120%, but if I can bump the price up to 140, I don't have to worry about it. In other words, what you don't want is insurers gaming the system in such a way that the system breaks down because it becomes a higher and higher percentage of the market, and you've really taken flood insurance out of the private sector. So they're the two concepts. I haven't elaborated deeply on either one, but that's what I wanted to put to you today. So going back, there's the three models, full flood opt-out or status quo, where full flood is really the only one that would solve the, if you like, the political and community problem that's been evident in Brisbane and Ipswich. But if you go down that route, then you've got to deal with all those three mechanisms referred to at the bottom of this slide, and one of them is to determine a risk threshold. I think that'll do me for now, but they're the ideas I wanted to put to you today, and I'm happy to take questions.
So I've got a couple of questions to John, and we'll then move on. John's going to stay with us whilst our other three speakers present their material, and then we'll have an all-in discussion. From SMS, so for full flood cover, I'll pay an extra premium for a home 300 metres above sea level, eh?
I don't know where that comes from.
Actually, you'll need the microphone.
Well, that's an assumption by whoever it is asked the question. It's not obvious that that would be the case. Although it is obvious that if you have a discount mechanism, the price or the funding has to come from somewhere.
So where's that likely to come from?
Well, there are really three main options, aren't there? One is from the insurance industry, which ultimately means from all policyholders, and it would be, yes, for a home 300 metres above sea level. It could be for all councils to pay, which means that the ratepayers would end up paying it, or it could be...
All councils throughout Australia would pay for it.
Well, I'm just giving you an example of the kinds of ways it could be dealt with. Yes, you would need a mechanism somewhere, and it could be taxpayers generally.
I'm just asking, you're not suggesting that only councils likely to be affected by flood would pay it.
I'm being quite agnostic about that. There are any number of different formulae you might apply, and you could consider all councils or only those in flood-prone areas. One of the problems if it's in flood-prone areas is that you've already said the insurance is unaffordable, and now we're going to come back at it through rates. And the councils might wish to... If councils tried to apportion it in the same way that insurers would, that is on the flood risk, then you're back where you started.
And you think of local government areas, some of them are particularly prone, fully prone, others are quite large where they're semi-prone, for example, so that there'd be major geographic political issues in getting councils to pay the premium.
What I was trying to steer away from today was talking too much about the pricing and funding issues. But it's pretty clear that if you are going to have a set of discounts, then you've got to fund them from somewhere. And there are many different ways you could come at that.
Okay, another couple of questions. If a full flood cover is pursued, how about earthquakes or cyclones?
Well, the reason we're talking about full flood cover is because the insurance market either doesn't offer it or doesn't offer it at what is seen to be a reasonable price. That's not the case for earthquake and cyclone. The insurance industry has shown itself quite capable of offering that cover at a reasonable price. There's one qualification on that, and that is in northern Queensland, we are seeing a thin market for some classes of insurance as insurers... Some insurers say, well, it's just too much trouble to be up there. It's a bit pricey. I'm not sure if I want to have exposure there. So there's a risk that we don't have a fully competitive market in Queensland. But the other side of this is that the insurance industry has shown itself quite capable of funding earthquake, cyclone, bushfire and flood. It knows it can offer flood cover, but at the moment, people aren't buying it in some areas or some companies aren't offering it.
Now, another question. Wouldn't the discounts represent unfair subsidies to some people who have already bought their properties in full knowledge of the risks?
Well, that would depend how you structure the discounts. And that itself is also an extensive topic. I gave one sort of simplistic indication, future new properties, no discount, existing properties or maybe properties built more than 20 years ago or something, no discounts. You could also consider having discounts that are not permanent. You could offer discounts for 5 years or 10 years or 15 years and phase them out, or there's a range of things that could be done there. And part of what I'm trying to get across here is there are really three different issues. The first is the threshold. Where is the high risk? Where's the low risk? Secondly, what kind of pricing do you want to apply to the high risk? And it's very clear that you don't want to do anything that's going to put the incentives in the wrong place, which is the other big problem about subsidies in flood areas. And thirdly, how are you going to fund whatever discounts or subsidies you
want? The last question for now, and this is also from SMS, why is some limited cover option not being considered to limit the subsidy? Should a $2 million house get a discount, for example?
I'm not saying yes or no about anything like that. All those things will be in the issues paper, and I just wanted to put enough on the table today to illustrate what we think the big issues are. And the panel will welcome that kind of question and any other questions you can think of once we get our issues paper out. And that would be the real strength of this. If we can draw in people in this audience and people outside this audience who have an interest in this and can help us over the remainder of our work, which goes through to September, to formulate a workable solution, then that would be a good outcome.
Just reading between the lines, you're running this government inquiry. You spent quite a lot of your time talking about full flood cover. Do the political tea leaves point in that direction?
Well, as I tried to explain at the outset, the big issue is the fact that many people who've got insurance do not have flood cover. Mm. And so you get a big flood, lots of people aren't covered, either knowingly or unknowingly. Some are partially covered and didn't realise it. It's very clear that, let me put it another way. There's huge trauma in North Queensland around Yarsi. There's big trauma in Toowoomba and Lockyer Valley. There's huge trauma over in Christchurch. But at least all the people who chose to insure there in all those places have basically got insurance cover. So their financial losses are limited. But in addition to all of that, you've got people in Ipswich and Brisbane who've got all the trauma of the disaster, and also they're badly out of pocket. Mm. And that's the part that needs to be dealt with.
Okay, good place to finish there, John. So stay right there. And John's going to take further questions as we move to the discussion stage after our next three speakers.